Welcome to the Tribcast. This is Philip Martin with Progress Texas. Evan and Ross are both out this week, which means this is going to be the best Tribcast ever. Take it away, Reeve.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the second week in July. Joining me is editor Emily Ramshaw.
Hi, Reeve.
Reporter Julian Aguilar.
Hello.
And golden-voiced correspondent Jay Root.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us.
It's true. Thanks for having me. Evan and Ross are on vacation. Evan is in Canada. Ross is
New York.
I don't know, probably at Disney World.
No, he's in New York.
I don't think the point of them going on vacation is so that we tell everyone where they are.
Well, the point is that we have a grand old time in their absence.
Oh, yeah. Now the stakes have been raised a little bit high for this thing. Are you chewing gum?
No, I'm not.
What is it, a cough drop?
Chewing tobacco.
Jay just stuck something in his mouth.
It's a Jolly Rancher, I bet.
Well, you know, we said they're on vacation so we can have fun, right?
I guess.
He's on acid.
I am reading Fear and Loathing right now,
it's
so.
It's his cud.
There are no drugs on this. Actually, but that's a good segue into we're going to talk about the
handbook
violation. The Mexican elections and what it means for the drug war and the relationship with the state of Texas.
Sure.
And the country of Mexico.
All right.
But first, I think we're going to start with Rick Perry and the latest on healthcare.
Oh.
Right. We're going in reverse chronological
jumped right
order.
Right over Julian.
Yep.
We're going to get back to Julian.
Yeah.
All right. So, I mean, the latest, which everybody knows at this point, is that Rick Perry sent a very firmly worded letter to Kathleen Sebelius at HHS this week, basically saying, that Medicaid expansion thing y'all are talking about, we aren't going to do it. And that health insurance exchange that we're supposed to put in place, we're not going to do it, and you can do it if you want to.
And he's not the first governor to...
No, the governors of Louisiana, Florida, and Wisconsin have all also said no thanks to the money, which for Texas, this would be about $100 billion between 2014 and 2019 at a cost to Texas of about $6 billion. So really, pretty much everybody who's done any sort of financial analysis of this has said Texas is getting the biggest bang for its buck of any state if it were to accept this money. But Perry has pretty bluntly said, we're not going to accept this money. Now, I think this is a big bluff, and I'll go on record saying that. Y'all
you
might disagree. Oh, right. This thing's on?
We don't edit these things.
I think, you know, this is the power play that has to happen. I think $100 billion at the end of the day is so much money that Texas is not going to stand by and watch that money go to other states. I think at the end of the day, you know, there can be some pretty tense negotiations where Texas really, you know, can use this to its advantage and say to the feds, look, you know, we have so many uninsured people here. You want us to play ball with this Medicaid expansion. You really want us to be part of this. Otherwise, it's going to look like a loss for the Obama administration. In which case, the feds might say, you know, all right, we've got all this money. You have all these uninsured people. Let's try to negotiate some kind of deal where it doesn't look like Perry's going back on his word, where Texas gets more flexibility to sort of design this program the way that it wants to. I think these lines of communication are more open than you might have thought by listening to Perry on Fox News. I think it was political.
Well, speaking of his appearance on Fox News, that was just an interesting interview because it seemed clear that he was going on Fox News to make this announcement and sort of expecting to be sort of congratulated and held up. And the reporter on Fox News really, like, laid into him.
Yeah.
And he got very nervous. He started fidgeting with his earpiece.
It was an awkward... I think that interview was kind of awkward because he clearly was having problems hearing. And so, you know, she would ask him one question, ask him about the Medicaid expansion, and he answered the question about a health insurance exchange. And it became pretty obvious that he was having, like, a, you know, very difficult time with his earpiece. So I think it came across as sort of more awkward and less probably authoritative and fierce than he probably expected that it would.
So you don't think there's much to read into that?
I wouldn't necessarily read into seemingly nervousness. I think he knew what he wanted to say and you know, came out swinging. But this is the logical next step for, a governor who ran for president on an anti-Washington platform, basically, and, B, for a state that just spent a lot of time and energy, not to mention money, filing suit against the federal government over the tenets of this law. So it's not like we could say, you know, roll over right now and say, all right, cool, we're going to take the money and we're going to make our own health insurance exchange and, you know, it's all done.
Well, so
don't you think it's one of these deals, too, where, like, Obama gets a benefit from it and Perry gets a benefit from it? It's sort of like when there's a death penalty case between Mexico and the U.S. The Mexicans get all exercised about it, about some Mexican national, and then the on the Texas side, we say, you know, well, don't come over here and murder anybody, and then everybody goes home happy. I mean, that's kind of where we
except the guy that was executed.
Yeah, like
except
the guy going home happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, almost everybody.
I mean,
goes
it's home like happy. I mean, right? They're sort of talking past each other right now. Is there any real hope that maybe Medicaid could actually be reformed? Because it is kind of a messed up program.
It's a totally
isn't it?
Messed I mean, up it, program.
I mean, there's no incentives for people to have healthy behaviors, and it's kind of a messed up program.
Well, the line that the conservatives in the legislature use that the Democrats hate is this line about having skin in the game. And, you know, I mean, Republicans want to devise a Medicaid system where Texas has more control over it and where people are, you know, sort of more motivated to, you know, get preventive care, for example, to not show up in an emergency room, which is more expensive, when they could go to a primary care physician. So, you know, I think there is a likelihood that you know, in some ways, again, Washington has shown some willingness. In the last year, Texas now has, you know, a big Medicaid waiver. It's called the 1115 waiver, where Texas negotiated with the feds in the last year to get some leeway to run Medicaid the way Texas wanted to. I think, again, despite, you know, Perry's comments on TV this week, I think those lines of communication are open, and I think it's far more likely that we come to some kind of middle ground.
How does this play politically among Texans? Obviously, this comes right on the heels of the ranking that was widely covered that had Texas as, you know, the state with the worst insurance coverage.
Worst insurance, but then, you know, a couple days later, it's the best business climate in the country. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the challenge is that the people who would be most affected by a Medicaid expansion are generally young Hispanic males. And guess who doesn't vote in Texas consistently?
Well, let's see.
Other than Julian, young Hispanic males. You know, I think this again gets, everyone says, you know, well, how are voters going to react? And, you know, are more people going to storm to the polls in November because, you know, they fear that they're not going to be part of the Medicaid expansion? The people who might be eligible for a Medicaid expansion traditionally have not been the people who voted in Texas. And until
I think this is good for Rick Perry,
right?
Because it completely fits into the narrative that he has been spinning since at least 2009, which is that you have this overreaching federal government who's coming in here and says one size fits all. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a gift to Rick Perry,
sure.
Unquestionably. But I agree with Emily, too, that, you know, eventually we're going to go through a legislative session, and it's going to be, I mean, $100 billion is a lot of dough. The unemployment, the unemployment money was, you know, $500 million. I mean, you know, it's a lot of money, but not this kind of money.
Right.
But that is true, though, speaking of, you know, he can't just do this unilaterally, right? He has to work with the legislature.
So, right. I mean, Perry's comments made it sound like he could do it unilaterally, and we started sort of getting these quiet phone calls from Republicans in the legislature that were like, no, hey, wait a second. Like, isn't this our decision? And so I think, you know, he then sort of, you know, backtracked a little and curbed those statements and said, just so it's clear, you know, I'm going to work with the legislature. I'm going to push very hard for them to make sure that we don't accept this funding. You know, again, there's a long legislative session ahead of us where everybody and their mother is going to want to weigh in on this. And so I think it's more likely we end up with some kind of legislation, maybe authored by some of the more sort of moderate Republicans in the legislature, that directs HHSC to negotiate with the feds to come up with some kind of deal that's good for Texas.
Because if you have hospital districts that have all this uncompensated care, and you have a funding source that's 100% paid for 4 years, and then 90% paid for, 9-1, $1 you get 9 back. I mean,
yeah, I mean, the hospitals had to go on record. You know, the hospitals hate disagreeing with Rick Perry, and they had to go on the record almost immediately disagreeing with Rick Perry and saying, you know, we absolutely need this money. So I think that creates, again, a pretty powerful lobbying force in a legislative session.
And then, but if you go through the legislative session, then that sort of repositions you to sort of say, like, oh, we're coming up with a Texas solution.
Right,
that,
exactly.
Like,
then it doesn't look like you changed your tune.
I thought the Democrats' reaction was rather muted, which isn't shocking given the state of the Democratic Party, but it was like, sadly, Rick Perry has put politics above policy mm-hmm. instead of, you know, are you crazy? Like, what? I mean, did you not catch that? Or
what else can they say, though?
Yeah, I wonder if they would be covered any differently if they had sort of been more, you know, at this point, they're just such a small group of group that's sort of written off by some reporters, Jay, that, you know, I think no matter what they said, that would have been muted.
I think the Whigs are making a comeback.
No, but I really, mean, what would you expect them to do differently, I think, in their response?
I mean...
I just puke or something. I don't know. Like, really, I mean, really, you know, really get upset. I don't know. I just, it seemed muted to me for some reason.
First, they thought it was a win, you know, that this got upheld. And then they realized that the Supreme Court had really gutted a major part of health reform by saying that this Medicaid expansion was, you know, optional. And so, you know, they're stung. I'm not sure they know what they can do at this point. You know, we have a presidential election upcoming where, you know, if Romney sweeps into office, you know, he said he would like states to be able to opt out of the entire thing, you know. I mean, and he would grant states waivers to do that. So I think there is sort of this waiting game, you know.
Right, that's a good point.
You know, I don't know what we could expect the Democrats to say other than to be mad, and, you know, I've gotten a fair number of those angry emails. So
I think Jay just wanted a sort of flashy press conference.
Yeah,
but
maybe.
Then I suspect
he loves to cover those
then
flashy
I suspect
press conferences.
Someone might have said that there was sort of a cheesy, overdone press conference.
Yeah, you're probably right. Okay, like I stand down.
All right,
but he's not going to puke.
No puking. We're moving on to our next topic as we rapidly approach topic number two. Don't puke.
Are you going to make a connection between puking and the Mexican election?
Well, I don't know. Julian's the one that went down there.
I didn't see any vomiting in the streets. I saw a lot of protests and a lot of people sort of curious about what happens in Mexico in the next 6 years. First things first, the leftist candidate, AMLO, Mr. López Obrador, who lost narrowly in 2006, he lost by about 7 percentage points, a few million votes. He's not going away. Jay, you're familiar with his tactics.
Presidente legítimo.
Yeah, he didn't come out on election night, you know, pounding his fist on the podium, very upset, but he said, we're going to wait and see what happens. And lo and behold, he says that he has evidence that 5 million votes were bought by the PRI. He's going to present this evidence on Thursday. But the PRI, which is the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which held power for 71 years last century and is poised to reclaim Los Pinos, Mexico City, because their candidate, Enrique Peña Nieto, got about 38% of the vote.
This is the Texas Tribune en Español.
Anyway, moving forward.
I was thinking the same thing.
But the most of the world and Mexico is moving forward with the mindset that the PRI will return to power. And before the election, a lot of state lawmakers had some concerns that they would go back to their former ways of allegedly making deals with cartels. You ask a lot of folks in Mexico, though, they say, you know, if there's some sort of behind-the-scenes deal, but it means that we can go out after dark and not fear, you know, be fearful to take our children to school in the morning, then we'll take it. Mr. Peña Nieto said he's going to modify somewhat Mr. Calderon's strategy, which means focusing on the fiercest elements of organized crime. So we can sort of wait and see what happens. I think the immigration issue moving forward, it's going to play out a lot. We'll see how it plays out after November with our election and to see what sort of dialogue Washington and Mexico City have as far as illegal immigration, which is slow to a trickle, according to some people. Jay? Emily?
Is it true that Peña Nieto's wife is a soap star?
It is true that she was a soap star. You know,
what does that mean for our relationship with
right.
them?
It doesn't really mean anything. It means that he has a wife that has gotten a lot of attention. It was traditionally before the PRI would not parade around the Mexican first ladies, but you know, Fox was the first president in 2000 to have his wife actually address the nation. President Calderon's wife has been pretty visible, and I suspect that Mr. Peña Nieto's wife will probably be in the spotlight as well.
So how's this news being received in Texas? Are we looking forward to the return to the PRI, or are we...
It depends on who you talk to. You know, Henry Cuellar has hosted Mr. Peña Nieto in Washington quite a few times. Henry Cuellar is the congressman from Laredo in South Texas. He says, you know, that's not going to be a significant change. What happened the last 12 years under Bond Rule is they pretty much laid the groundwork for transparency and democracy in Mexico, which hadn't really been seen the last century. So now, say you take the former ambassador, Antonio Garza, he said, you're not going to see a rejection of Mexico the last 12 years with this election. What you're going to see is the PRI having to move forward in a different way. Now they have a youth movement that's going to hold them accountable, whoever is in office. What that means for Texas, it depends on who you ask. You have Republicans mostly concerned about the drug war and how Mr. Peña Nieto handles it. And you have Democrats saying this is fine, you know, that's our largest trading partner, which it is. And they're a little bit more optimistic about the relationship moving forward.
Republicans like State Representative Lyle Larson, who sent a bill to the Mexican government.
Well, he sent a letter to President Calderon in April saying that the Mexican government should reimburse Texas between $6 to $8 billion that Texas spends providing services to the Mexicans that are living here illegally. He said it was just to begin a new dialogue. Moving forward, he said he's probably going to continue with the same effort. The Mexican government, I guess they acknowledged they received the letter, but they hadn't really responded.
They didn't send a check?
Yeah, they didn't send
Maybe
a check.
Maybe they're in that same sort of waiting period. They were in that waiting period that we are now,
sure,
waiting to see who the next leader will be. And now the new leader is in. I bet that response just comes like lightning.
Yeah, they're just waiting for the exchange rate to get better before, you know, they,
yeah,
they
right,
hand
exactly
over, you know, the equivalent. But, and you know, and Senator Cornyn has lashed out against Calderon, you know, 2 years ago for Calderon accusing the U.S. of fueling the violence with our gun laws, you know, anti-immigration policies. So there's been a lot of rhetoric back and forth. But at the same time, because of this trade relationship and because of this cultural sort of symbiotic relationship, people are very, very careful on how they address Mexico. And same thing, Mexico is very careful on how they address the U.S.
I think it's kind of sticking with the muted theme. I think that it's kind of amazing.
The Democrats did not respond to this election well enough.
No, in a different way. I think it was kind of interesting how there just wasn't a whole lot of coverage of it here. It didn't break through, I didn't think. You know, here you have the
Except for Julian's coverage.
Well, obviously, it was our great coverage.
That's
but I mean, it just
that's why you got on the Tripcast this week.
I mean, it wasn't. It didn't seem to be as big of a deal as I thought it was. I mean, here you have the pre that was sort of this iron-fisted rule for 71 years, and there obviously, you know, in previous elections there was a lot of vote rigging that went on, and a lot of abuses that happened, and so here you have this obviously a reformed pre that's coming back. But I also think it's sort of the end of the whole PAN era with, you know, Vicente Fox started as the one who put an end to the 71 years of pre-rule.
Sure.
Calderon was his successor in the PAN. They now have gotten blown out in the Mexican Congress. The PRI has a plurality, correct, in the Mexican Congress?
Yeah.
They have the biggest block. So now you got the president and the biggest block in Congress. So I would suspect that a lot of the reforms that got bottled up in the previous two administrations, I mean, electricity, they have terrible rates of electricity, and you know, if you've ever called into Mexico, you know why Carlos Slim is the richest man in Latin America. Their phone rates are usurious, and their electricity, I mean, they have a lot of, they have all these monopolies, and I heard that he did talk about that, didn't he? Isn't that one of his platforms, that he wants to break up some of the monopolies?
It is. I mean, he went so far as to saying that he'd be open to discussing privatizing Pemex, which, as you know, is a huge, huge thing
right
in Mexico. I mean, the country celebrates as a national holiday the day that Pemex was nationalized, you know, in the 1930s or 40s. But that's one thing that I think is missing. A lot of people focus on the immigration issue and the drug issue, but Mexico still has one of the strongest economies in the world. It's growing at a faster pace than the U.S. economy. They have a balanced budget amendment, and they have billions in reserves in case the peso ever goes crazy,
right,
which everybody knows affects the Texas economy. But you're exactly right. I mean, he's talked about, you know, reaching out more to the middle class, and the former ambassador, Mr. Garza, said, you know, if they can get a handle on their, like you said, energy policies, their communication policies, and things that affect the middle class, then you'll see fewer and fewer Mexicans wanting to go elsewhere.
Right.
So I think that the United States also has a vested interest to keep an eye on that, not only the security issue, not only the immigration issue, but it's what's causing the illegal migration north.
Yeah, I think that we're going to have, the next few years is going to be really interesting to see a lot of the reforms that they're finally going to be able to do, that they need to do to, you know, some of these impediments to an economy that really is growing.
Sure. But what you said about the sort of muted response, I mean, standing in line to get our credentials at the BRI, I mean, you saw Japanese television, you
right
saw Germany. I mean, everybody else in the world was very, very focused because, I'm sure, because of the violence. I mean, you know, South American countries were there. But, you know, it could be said that, the U.S. response was muted because their bureaus are shrinking in Mexico City. Or maybe they just kind of take for granted the fact that Mexico is going to remain Mexico. But even though it's the BRI, I do think that there has been some key points said that the youth movement, the 18 to 30-year-old demographic that's been used to kind of holding the government accountable, they're going to keep going with that. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how this movement keeps going until December, when Mr. Peña Nieto is sworn in, barring any, you know, unforeseen court cases or what Mr. López Obrador does. But I think there are definite mechanisms in place now that were not in place last century when the PRI ruled Mexico for 71 years.
It also came in the midst of a flurry of healthcare news, which I think everyone was sort of excited about. And we can really only sustain one major story a week, I think.
as a news economy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our focus is only, you know, so broad. What is the voter turnout? How does that in Mexico compare to
it?
Voter turnout was the highest in history. It was out of 79.4 million eligible voters, about between 63-64% turned out.
Wow.
Yeah.
Goodness. What's ours?
Not that.
Throwing around stats about Texas, at least Texas is ranked in the bottom 10, bottom 20% every election cycle. As far as a country, I don't know how that compares as far as overall. But no, and Mr. Peña Nieto, he received the most votes for any presidential candidate. He beat Ernesto Zedillo's record.
What was his percentage?
About 38.3%, which is another thing, which reflects the fact that the PRI isn't, you know, going in strong arm like they were used to last century, because before there were landslide victories.
No, but if you look at it, it's really like it shows what did the PAN candidate do?
She received about 25 and change. AMLO got about 31 and change. And
so if you add AMLO, who is a complete leftist,
sure,
with the PRI, which is far to the left of the PAN,
sure,
you know, center left, then you basically have a center left majority,
sure,
a very strong lock center left majority in Mexico.
Even the president of the PAN, he said it was worse than we expected. So this was definitely a referendum
on
Calderón and Fox and the policies they laid down as far as security and as far as the economy. So yeah, I mean, they pretty much got blown out of the water. To the fact where the party is talking about expelling former President Fox for saying positive things about Mr. Peña Nieto. So there's a definite, it's sort of like the one faction wants to unite and move forward, and then there's still the splintering factions that want to keep Mexico the way Mexico has been.
Of course, our voter turnout could totally change after voter ID goes into effect.
It could. That's a nice segue, Reeve.
Thanks.
That's being argued in D.C. right now, and we'll wait and see what happens after Friday. But they have until next month to make a decision. It will likely be appealed, in which case it goes directly to the Supreme Court. And, well, obviously not going to be in place for the runoff, but it's a coin flip to see if it's going to be in place for the November general election.
Any other final thoughts about your trip down to Mexico?
I had a good time.
Things were blowing up, though, right?
Yeah, that's another thing. You know, there's not going to be
like
a sea
literally
change of you know, a curb in violence overnight. Actually, some people say leading up to the inauguration, there's going to be even more. Yesterday, Tuesday, and mañana in Nuevo Laredo, they threw a Molotov cocktail. Nobody was hurt. And then two other newspapers, one in Monterrey and one in Guadalupe outside of Monterrey, they were part of El Norte, received gunfire and, you know, homemade grenades or whatnot. So, and in Nuevo Laredo, there was a car bomb the Friday before the election on Sunday. So, yeah, I don't think anybody is, you know, marching in the street right now saying we're safe and we're free. We're wait and see mode.
All right. Well, Jay, when Jay is not marching in the street,
he's dancing.
He's always working on something. So we thought we would close this out by checking in on Jay's thoughts.
Well, my thought is I've been covering this U.S. Senate runoff between David Dewhurst and Ted Cruz, and you know, we're sort of in that really hot phase now where pretty much every day there's people are saying that, you know, one camp is accusing the other camp of something really awful. Today we had a story about Ted Cruz getting fined $200, which is the maximum fine.
But that's not very much money.
Still not that much money.
It's not $100 billion.
It's definitely not $100 billion.
No, but so he got fined $200 for failing to file his personal financial statement, where you say where you make your money, et cetera. And in his case, who some of his legal clients are. That's where some of the controversy has been.
So he was 2 months late?
He was 2 months late.
Only $200, and nobody noticed, including us?
All right. So there's two different – yeah, there's two different things. Okay, first of all,
right,
here's the way this went down. So last week, we if you go to the Senate Office of Public Records and you say where is Ted Cruz's personal financial statement? They said, you know, we don't have it, and the deadline is May 15th, and or possibly sometime before that, although it's very difficult to say because the Senate Ethics Committee really won't give you any interpretation of their rules. And if you call them, they'll say, you know, everything's off the record and you can't really quote these people.
So what'd they tell you?
So anyway, we went to Ted Cruz on Thursday and said, just caught him alone and said, hey, what about your personal financial statement? He said, I don't know that it's late. I don't know anything about it. And so then we went to the campaign, and it, you know, after a few days, they said, well, we'll get back to you. And then on Tuesday, yesterday, I find out that they actually had filed it. They filed it yesterday, the day before. So on Monday, they overnighted it to Washington. So on July 9th, you know, almost 2 months after the May 15th deadline, they did it because we alerted them. Apparently, that's what John Drogan, the campaign manager, told me, was that they filed it because we alerted them. So he, you know, according to them, he didn't know that he was supposed to turn this in before the election.
That's a staffer problem.
Until we alerted them.
Yeah. Okay.
So
problem.
So there's that. But
so something has gone. That's Cruz's
right.
personal finance stuff has gone missing, but something's also gone missing from the Dewhurst campaign, right?
Right. So now now another story that we're working on today, actually, is there's a speech that David Dewhurst gave in 2007 in which he's basically expressed support for a guest worker program to which people who are here illegally could apply to and get work papers. And that was in 2007. Well, Peggy Feacock from the Houston Chronicle wrote this story about this speech, and the Cruz people said this proves that David Dewhurst is for amnesty, and then the speech goes missing from the internet site. And today, the Lieutenant Governor's office told me that actually a little more than a year ago, somebody, we don't know who yet, but somebody in the Lieutenant Governor's office asked that all of his speeches be archived, and that was never done. And then they found out, and we don't know when yet, but we can only presume that it was they found out after Peggy wrote her story and it blew up and became a big issue, that they said, oh, hey, remember when we asked you a year ago to archive all that stuff? Can y'all go ahead and do that? And apparently they did. That's the story that we're getting today out of the Lieutenant Governor's office.
But they confirmed
that very recently they took down all of David Dewhurst's speeches off of the internet.
In this campaign, what's his position on guest worker programs been?
That he's against it.
Do you think
that's what's very interesting is this speech is completely, and if you look at the whole speech is actually very interesting. It sounds like it's a very, you know, it was on the occasion of being named Mr. South Texas. And he went down there.
Formerly held by State Senator Judith Zavarini.
Do you wear a sash and a crown when you get
and Speaker Joe
Do you know
Strauss.
Anything about that? No, it's like a big deal with they have that ball, and it's like the George Washington type thing.
It's the Washington's birthday celebration,
right.
And then they have the abrazo ceremony with Nuevo Laredo, but it's like a week-long thing, and it's like a debutante thing slash, you know, let's honor somebody from
so
Texas.
So in Laredo and in South Texas, it is a very big deal.
Yeah.
And so he goes down there and gives this speech.
Do you
and
get it, nominated?
And it's,
how does it work?
It's a committee. It's a selection committee. Speaker Strauss had that title. So did Senator Zaffarini. Like you said, Congressman Cuellar, there's been a whole slew of them that have gone through.
But none of
the
us.
The whole tone of this
not
speech.
I nominate you, Reed, next time.
The whole tone of this speech was very much, I'm against walls. I'm humane, anti-wall, border walls. Nobody's humane anymore.
Right.
Humane is not PC
well,
anymore.
What are you going to say when you're in South Texas and you got the biggest inland port and you got, you know, billions of
it's so nice to be outside
everywhere.
Where there are no walls.
Well, yeah, but then you run for U.S. Senate
exactly.
5 years later.
So what other speeches were up there that are no longer there?
That's a good question. I have no idea. I really don't.
The speech about the TSA.
Maybe we'll find out. I mean, you know, nobody's denying that he delivered the speech. Nobody's denying that he made that remark.
Right.
When you ask the campaign, hey, why did he say this? Well, I don't know why you said that, but I can tell you his position today is this.
Couldn't his position have evolved a la Obama's gay marriage beliefs over time?
We don't have a lot of detail on that evolution, but yes, I presume.
I bet his evolution speech is also off the website.
I mean, if you were running for something, would you want this open, like, archive of every speech you'd ever given right there for your opposition's taking? You know, for campaign ads and all that kind of stuff? I mean, you know, anything can be, you know, taken in as a sort of snapshot or taken out of context or...
I think what Emily
is
saying...
Yeah, but here's... Okay, here's
when
the problem.
When I run for office...
You want to be as non-transparent as possible. If you're
right, okay. I completely... Sure. if the order had been executed a year or more than a year ago when they said, take all these speeches down, I don't think we would be talking about this.
Right.
Now, somebody probably would have uncovered it. I mean, because then you just like go, oh, hey, we're looking for your speeches. Then you get a thumb drive with all these speeches on it. And then, you know, it would probably have ended up coming out anyway. The problem is that once the horse is out of the barn,
Cat's out of the bag.
You know, then you go shut the barn door, as somebody suggested.
Or the bag door.
Right.
So what has the Democrats' response to this been?
Muted.
All right. That's it. If you have questions or comments or would like to nominate anyone on the Tribcast for the title of Mr. South Texas, please email.
What about Mrs.?
You are always Mr. No. Yeah. Senator Zeffirini was
what?
Mr. South Texas. Hey, man. Yeah.
Time out.
Send a strongly worded letter to the committee.
No, time in. The email is tribcast@texastribune.org. On behalf of Jay, Emily, Julian, our producer Todd, this has been the best Tribcast ever. This is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
All right.
All right, all right, all right.